Well, kia ora tātou, and I'm very pleased to say joining us today for this very special podcast here on the Big Q Project for Public Interest Media is Dame Claudia Orange. She is one of New Zealand's most distinguished historians, and her very famous book, which was released in 1987, The Treaty of Waitangi, Te Tiriti o Waitangi, has been reissued, an illustrated history by Bridget Williams Books. And we're very privileged to have her here to talk a bit about the book, about the treaty, and about just where we stand, I guess, in 2021. So thank you very much for joining us, Claudia.
Thanks, Sam. I'm pleased to be able to talk with you.
Well, I was going to ask firstly about where you started with your research and, I guess, interest in the treaty. Where did that come from?
It's not difficult to answer. I was doing a master's thesis in 1970s, and I found that the Labour government in 1920, or Labour Party, actually, in 1925, put out a policy that if it became the government, it would do something about introducing a commission of inquiry into treaty claims. Took them a long time to do it. Matt Rata succeeded 50 years later, of course, in 1975. So that was so fascinating that when I finished the master's thesis, I decided to ask that big question, as really, has this treaty in New Zealand been as important as people say it has been?
Did you have much knowledge or understanding of the treaty before then?
Not a lot. I certainly had a father who had been in Māori affairs all his life, and he spoke fluent Māori, and I was accustomed to Māori needs and issues being discussed over the dinner table.
Mm-hmm. Because the treaty before then, would you say it didn't really have much sway in a lot of the minds of Pākehā people?
I think probably by and large people had more or less ignored it as anything that was absolutely crucial. Mm. So on the other hand, there had been a lot of Māori voices, but people were not very good at listening to what was being said. And that was true both of the 19th century and right into the 20th century.
In terms of the writing of history, who did you draw on for inspiration when it came to writing about the treaty? Had much history been written about it up till then?
Not a lot. A book in 1914 had come out and republished in 1930s by Lindsay Buick called The Treaty of Waitangi. But the person who had started to do quite a lot of work on the two copies of the treaty, the one in Te Reo and the one in English, was Ruth Ross, a lady who was a lady who had done a lot of work in Northland as a teacher. And at the university, she unfortunately realised she had cancer. And one day she quite formally said to me, "Look, it's about time that I handed over the job of exploring the treaty to you." So that was really quite a major thing for anybody to say in academia. And the other people, of course, that were important were those that I was doing Māori studies with, Rangi Nui Walker, Pat Hohepa, and others in that area.
Why was it that you think not much had been written about the treaty up until that point?
I think we just assumed as a people we'd done a very good thing by Māori, and the treaty had been the best treaty in the world. And we just didn't question that.
Right.
And so academics went off and did all sorts of other things, but not the treaty itself.
Mm-hmm. What were you looking for when it came to writing this book in terms of its purpose? What were you hoping to achieve out of it?
Basically, like with the very first book I did, and this book, of course, has taken us right through now to COVID. So it's added another three chapters. My purpose really is putting a documented narrative and treatment of the treaty in place so that mainly Pākehā would be able to perhaps better understand the history of this country and why we've got to where we are now, because there's absolutely nothing in history that, nothing now, that isn't affected one way or another by the past. So that's my purpose. Quite a lot of Māori too have said that it's been an extremely helpful thing to be able to have something to refer to, and it's got all the treaty signatories in it and also those settlements that have gone through.
Do you think the book contributed to opening up to many people, especially Pākehā, the treaty and the history of it?
Well, I'm hoping it would, Sam. But, I mean, everybody is working at a different pace.
Sure.
And let's face it, even over this Waitangi weekend, people will have lots of things they want to do with family, out of the beach and so on. But you just hope that they take a little time to think about what the treaty has actually meant, and especially if you think about really what was Maori understanding at first, that it was really the beginnings of a partnership in a new nation.
What do you think has changed since the book was originally published in terms of the treaty? Do you think it's been embraced more by New Zealand society, commanded greater attention? What do you think?
I think it certainly has. And initially, of course, a lot of people got very uptight about settlements going through. We're only looking at 25 years since the settlement process was established. So it's not very long. And this process itself was set up by government without a lot or perhaps any Maori involvement. So the process is not a perfect one. But at least it's taken us quite a long way down the track, and especially in the years probably 2008 onwards, we've seen treaty settlements go through, and they really haven't hit people with big surprises when there's a write-up in the paper or online. There's greater acceptance that this is where we really have to do something to address so that we can feel more comfortable about living in the present and also looking at where things are going to go.
Do you think Waitangi Day has contributed to raising public awareness more?
Yes, I do, actually. The government back in the early 1990s, Ministry for Culture and Heritage, assigned a certain budget every year and to encourage people around the country to think about it. And that's pretty important, Sam, because it wasn't just signed at Waitangi and in the Hokianga and at Kaitaia. We're actually talking about 9 copies of the treaty going around the country, including the South Island, of course, and all around the Cook Strait and up the Kapiti Coast area to Whanganui. So you're talking about over 500 people signing those that treaty, all of them from different hapū.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the issue of redress as a result of historical treaty breaches? Do you think enough is being done or has been done to address a lot of these issues?
I think a lot has been done, and certainly the settlements have been good. But there is actually more that could be done. Sometimes it's in the settlements themselves. I think when the amount of redress in a funding sense is presented to iwi, it sometimes doesn't seem adequate for the amount of loss they've gone through. And then there's a certain searching for other elements of redress, like perhaps land, and that becomes much more difficult for government to address. That would include conservation land and also crown land too. It's not impossible to solve, but it is something that of course makes settlements slower to take through.
Well, a good example of that, I guess, is Ngāpuhi, which still hasn't got a treaty settlement.
Yes, it's probably not so much Ngāpuhi. It's a number of others, like perhaps Maniapoto.
Right.
Ngāti Maniapoto.
Right.
I mean, quite right currently, that's still being addressed. And, you know, there will be elements about what Maniapoto were perhaps hoping for that the government is finding hard to meet. Requirements or requests, whereas Ngāpuhi is a different matter, and I think the Minister, Andrew Little, has certainly responded very well, both to the acknowledgement that he's dealing with hapū rather than iwi, and that, of course, is exactly what the treaty was about. It was with hapū and not with iwi. But he also, of course, the recent decision of $150 million, I think it is, to set up an investment fund which can be drawn on for a range of reasons. That's excellent.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to talk about the issue of history in schools, and this is a topic that's just re-emerged in the last 2 days with the revelations of a new curriculum, which
right.
looks like it's going to be introduced. What do you make of the issue of teaching the treaty and New Zealand history in schools?
I certainly supported the petition that Graham Ball put to government. I was delighted how swiftly they responded. Chris Finlayson supported that too. He was on the committee we were discussing the request. It's going to take quite a lot of bringing together the resources, but that's not impossible. Every settlement that goes through has an authentic history attached to it in the deed of settlement. And I think the way they have addressed it with each area of the country, addressing some of the issues, is actually going to make it really, really interesting. We need a broad approach. And the only real struggle might be training teachers adequately, because this is a year 1 to 10. So that's a very broad group of the school people being addressed on this. But the real plus about it, let's face it, is that history and knowing more about it is going to gradually destroy some of the myths that people have about different aspects.
Right. I was going to talk about that, actually. Do you think this, in the long term, is going to make a difference in kind of making people more understanding and more aware of what the treaty is, that they will kind of do away with a lot of the ideas that are built up in their own minds about the treaty and Māori?
Well, I suppose one would hope that I could agree, we could agree with what you've just said. One of the dilemmas is that people are carrying with them quite a lot of baggage. It's probably something that they've heard from when they were kids in the home. They might have had a bad experience at some stage with Māori. When you think about it, a lot of people find it very, very hard to concede authority to others and to concede that freedom that others also need to exercise power. So we're really talking about, who holds power and how is it addressed? Mm-hmm. How is it shared?
Now, you were talking earlier about the reissue of the book and how you've included 3 new chapters into it. Can you tell us a bit about what those chapters focus on?
Yes, the first one, of course, is the Labour period, Labour government-led period, 2000 to 2008, and then National coming in then with Chris Finlayson holding the role of minister, and also tied in was that for the arts too, where he was able to work on various aspects of the treaty, such as the setting up of a museum at Waitangi. And then that, of course, in 2017, a change of government again to a coalition government. 2019, you have the setting up of that new independent agency, Te Arawhiti. If you translate that in English, it means the bridge. And it is a bridge. It's a bridge between the settlements that have gone through and also going out to all Māori, so that the settlements have to be honoured by the Crown. We certainly don't want to see us all having to do another total round of settlements. And also that body has some important roles, apart from ensuring the commitments to the treaty. There's also the Marine and Coastal Area Act that of 2011. And again, some of the applications to that are being addressed. And broadly, again, much more broadly, Te Arawhiti really has increasingly, I think, become an agency that gets some of the hard issues to solve. In education, in health, we've seen some important changes starting to take place in the judiciary, in the judicial area. There's water. I think water is not going to be the major problem that people in the past have thought it would be, whose rights are involved and how do we get to some good korero and decision-making. I think it's all feasible.
Right.
And maybe COVID has made a difference then.
True. Just one final question. Looking into where we are now and moving forward, do you think the treaty will still continue to have a prominent role in the future?
Well, it's very hard to say. Certainly, I think it would be very good to have all children in the nation at some stage going to Waitangi itself and having that experience up there. Sometimes it's the context of a place where you have to consider what went on there and how it has affected us. And let's face it, it is our founding document. That's part of our constitutional development. And so I think it's important to continue to have an evolutionary awareness, and that's going to take time. Not everybody's going to be ready for it. Everybody's going to be moving at different paces. But it's a pretty exciting time to be alive and to hope that you've made some difference, some influence on people's understanding.
Well, I guess compared to where we were when you first published the book, we seem to be in a much better place, for sure.
Absolutely. That's what I would hope to be the case, and I believe it probably is. So it will be interesting. Every Waitangi Day is another marker on the calendar. And increasingly, of course, MCH has succeeded in having many different Waitangi Day ceremonies around the country. It's really become a major family day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank you very much, Claudia, for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.